Hello everyone, I'm Dr. Madison McGladrey. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land I'm on today recording this podcast, the Whadjuk Noongar people. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and future, and extend that respect to all Indigenous peoples in our audience today. I'd also like to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded, Australia is stolen land, and always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So welcome to the first episode of In Queer Minds, a project emerging from the Human Rights Visionary Seed Grant from Curtin University. This is the first in a series of four episodes that explores the ideological and practical approaches of individuals operating within queer, intersectional, academic, activist, or community spaces. Initially, when I scripted today's episode, the topic was health, because of the backgrounds of our guests today. However, once I started preparing questions, it became evident that today's topic focuses more on matters of representation, what it means to represent, among other things, health concerns of queer and trans populations, and what ethical or political issues might come up. Joining me to discuss this today are our special guests, Associate Professor Sam Winter and Dr. Maria Palata Chiaroli, to speak to these topics in relation to their own work. So on behalf of my co-investigators in this project, Dr. Deb Hun and Dr. Bree McKenzie, thank you so much for joining me today. Before we get started, I'll introduce you properly. Associate Professor Sam Winter is a clinician, researcher, and teacher working in the field of trans health, well-being, and rights. Sam works here at Curtin in the School of Public Health. Dr. Maria Palata Chiaroli is an honorary fellow at the School of Communications and Creative Art at Deakin University and founder of the AGMC. Her areas of research include cultural diversity, gender diversity, sexual diversity, family diversity, HIV and AIDS, and social diversity in health and education, with a specific focus on adolescents and young people. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me, both of you.
Hi.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you. So both of you have worked on research involving how queer visibility is negotiated. To what extent is visibility important in the queer community and its intersections? And what are some issues, barriers, or conflicts with this? Sam, would you like to respond to that?
Well, my work is in the area of transgender health, well-being, and rights, and I think a major problem for trans people worldwide has been that of invisibility until relatively recently, even perhaps to some extent today. Invisibility within the LGBT umbrella, too often transgender people have been the poor brothers and sisters, to be a little bit binary about it, within the community of sexual and gender minorities, and invisibility in research too. Major problem has been invisibility in HIV and AIDS research for so many years. HIV and AIDS research within sexual and gender minorities conflated transgender people with men who have sex with men. And so a major fight for trans people and their allies, and I would count myself as an ally, in advocacy has been to make trans people visible.
Thank you, that's a very good response. Maria, how does your work inform your response to that question?
Yeah, it's a very, very important question. And first of all, Maddie, I am a founding member of the AGMC. I wish I was the founder of such an amazing organisation, but our founder was Cinzia Ambrosio. I think very importantly, not at all. I think very importantly, visibility is important. That's no doubt about that. We need to have representations. The amazing bisexual activist and writer B.J. Epstein said, text, art, visibility should be about being a window and a mirror, a window to the many worlds that are out there so that we do not misrepresent or underrepresent, you know, as Sam talks about, and also as a mirror. How do we see ourselves? What are the various ways that we can be and represent ourselves and curate a self or multiple selves? On the other hand, for some of the communities I work with, such as LGBTIQ plus from Muslim backgrounds, and this is not just stereotype Islam or any of those, any kinds of generalizations, but very importantly, visibility can sometimes bring harm from members of one's community or multiple communities, and harm to oneself because of the repercussions. So visibility is extremely important, but the safety and security and the ways we go about being visible in our AGMC Living and Loving in Diversity book, we had a couple of members of diverse cultural backgrounds who talked about why sometimes they prefer to stay invisible in a world that cries out for visibility.
And I'd just like to extend that across much of the world, merely to leave one's home as a transgender person puts one at risk of arrest, of violence, of police harassment. Visibility certainly can be a problem at the very, very most basic level. But as a community, it seems to me that the way forward in asserting one's rights and achieving equality and inclusion, broadly inclusion in society, is to make oneself visible as a community. It's a tricky one, isn't it, Maria?
It absolutely is, Sam, and because it's that complexity of, yes, we need visibility, we need people to be out there with lived experience representing themselves and their communities. At the same time, there can be danger with certain members of our communities in being very visible. And I think that's where, and you talked about yourself as an ally, which interestingly is how I see myself as an ally. And I think sometimes those of us with privilege can actually put ourselves out there without appropriating and without owning a way of being and representation. But there are ways that perhaps allies can open doors, take some risks that, say, for example, trans and gender diverse people I know from Muslim and other communities that I work with may not be able to yet, so that hopefully soon those issues of safety and concerns that we're both speaking about won't be there, that we can just bow out, get out of the way, and visibility will be safe.
Yes.
Thank you both for those responses. I think there's a dominant narrative about this idea that we need to do away with labels, that we need to all be this happy family kind of thing. Even the shifts to things like all gender bathrooms have sparked debates on that. And don't worry, this isn't a directed question, but just something I'd like to add. It is clear from what you're both saying about your research that visibility is important as a step to take for safety, so that people do not have to, I suppose, make themselves vulnerable in the future. Now, on visibility, both your work examines and makes visible previously underrepresented issues in marginalized populations. And while it's very important to correct negative narratives or stereotypes about trans people, about queer people, about families, about religious groups, how do you as researchers handle when you have to or must discuss issues that might be read by the public as confirming, and I'm using air quotes, but you can't see it because it's in a podcast. It's confirming negative beliefs about certain groups. For example, Maria, I'm thinking about a paper you published recently about discussing violence and homelessness. Maria, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, that's such an important question. And I'm sure that, with Sam's work as well, it's something that sits with us, and it should, in the way we do our research and do our representation. For me, and it's come up very recently because I'm working on a project called Mobs and Wogs, which is Aboriginal First Nations people. And I should have said from the beginning, apologies, I'm on Wurundjeri country, European name here, Melbourne. And it's really important when I look at First Nations peoples, Aboriginal peoples, and their relationships and the contestations with Southern European people, and the fact that we need to acknowledge that migrants, such as my background, were settler colonisers in Australia as well. And all those things come up very strongly. One of the ways, two things that are very important in doing this work for me is I constantly go back to systems and structures. So when I'm talking about violence amongst young people who are homeless, I talk about systems and structures and what led them to this violence. What are the causation effects in family, community, society, politics, economics? So the intersectional facets of that. When I talk about some of the horrific stories that have not been represented in Australian history between, say, Italian, Greek and Maltese migrants and their relationships, or relationships in air quotes, with Aboriginal people on whose land they also settled and colonised, I'm constantly aware of the White Australia policy, the other factors that were going on, and I tried to provide a different narrative as well. So, for example, my ancestors, I'm Italian background. My family came here, and they were part of getting away from fascism and reminding people that Mussolini and Italians had actually colonized northern Africa, which ended in destitution and you know, terrible. And that's how we ended up being in this country. So for me, I'd be interested in what Sam says in terms of psychology, because for me as a sociologist, I deconstruct the why, the how, who's invested in a particular narrative, and constantly go back to the bigger picture within which people are making decisions or are forced to make certain decisions and carry out certain behaviours.
Thank you. Sam?
I think in the area that I work in, trans health and well-being and rights, I think a major problem is that discrimination, prejudice, all of those things that go with it, harassment, marginalization, economic, legal, social, they so often rest at the individual level and at the level of organizations on a wide range of negative beliefs, stigmatizing beliefs. And I think that's one problem, I think, that one has to be aware of working in trans health. That is that there are widespread ideas that transgender people in some sense violate natural law, nature itself, violate, contradict God's law in some places, some people, violate the culture in which they live, that they are mentally disordered, and that they are deceivers and pretenders, and that they are, that their gender presentation, indeed even their identity, is motivated at base by sexual issues. And all of those negative, those stigmatizing beliefs actually feed into ideas about trans people in toilets, for example, their rights to be recognized as who they experience themselves as, and so one has to be aware of all of that. And so I think all the time I'm trying, and I'm not alone in this, I think we all try nowadays to emphasize that diversity is part of nature, part of the human experience, that it's something to be celebrated, that diversity doesn't mean disorder. We increasingly now one can refer to the decision of the World Health Organization to take the trans diagnoses that provide access to healthcare out of the mental disorders chapter into the one on conditions related to sexual health. I was very centrally involved in that, but it's another story for another program maybe. I think the negative. I'm rambling a bit here, so I don't want to. I should pull myself in a bit. I think the real problem, if one's talking about confirming negative beliefs, I think the real problem is when one actually is researching transsex work, because the very fact of transsex work feeds into one of those stigmatizing beliefs. That is that this whole thing is built on sexuality and sexual needs. That's a real problem, because the simple fact is that so many trans people worldwide are involved in sex work, not just trans women, but others too, because they need to put food on the table. They simply need to survive, and they may indeed be supporting their families. So, and there are not other options available for them. So I think one has to make that point. The point that I've just this second made, very, very forcibly indeed, where everyone is writing about trans sex work. I should stop there.
No, that's great. What I'm hearing from both of you is that your work involves so much of an unpacking between structures and individuals. Perhaps a lot of these negative stereotypes come from a base of, you know, suspicion of an individual. But what we in fact need to do is examine the structures that frame or produce that individual. For example, violence and homelessness or trans sex work. Thank you. That was a very good response.
And maybe an underlying message, the most fundamental message of all, perhaps, is to stress the point that trans people are people.
Yep.
That they are people, first of all, and they are trans, well, if not second, then maybe further down the line. They are people first, just like you, just like me, just like everybody, and they deserve the respect. That all humans involve. I mean, sounds so trite when I'm saying it there, but it really is a fundamental point, because I think that essential fact gets lost in so many people's minds when their thinking becomes governed by these stigmatizing beliefs, and that they are dehumanizing beliefs.
Absolutely, very well said, Sam. Maria, did you have a response?
Yeah, Sam, that's totally with you and support that. And I think sometimes we've got to be, applying the critical deconstruction, you know, I think about this demonization, vilification of trans sex workers. And also, you know, the upside of this is we've got to be careful not to constantly try to defend or justify. And what I mean is there are trans, just like anyone else who is perhaps coercively or perhaps selecting sex work as their career, if there are safety and other protocols in place. So, you know, and also, do we ever think about the clients? I mean, obviously there are people, you know, and usually they can be quite heteronormative, patriarchal, heteropatriarchal masculinities that we don't actually think about. So for me, again, the critical deconstruction approach is, yes, as Sam said, absolutely, the harm, marginalization, discrimination that leads people into homelessness or positions of vulnerability and having to do what they don't want to do. At the same time, let's go back and look at those systems and structures and think about very carefully about who's in power and who is creating certain situations and who's doing the vilification. I remember working in family violence, and I remember thinking about and researching how violence is, you know, being written about as perpetrated in same-sex relationships and et cetera. And just to remind, and that seemed to, for a while, I don't know what happened in Western Australia, but over here for a while it seemed to become this, oh, there you go, you know, gay men and lesbians, et cetera, are perpetrating violence. And just a reminder that the majority of the violence was and is still coming from heterosexual men in families against cisgendered women. So sometimes, you know, we've got to be careful not to try and defend or justify or anything like that, but let's turn the gaze back on to heteropatriarchy, hetero cisgendered patriarchy, and how, you know, and that's where we've got to look at what is happening and why.
Well said.
I hope that makes sense.
It absolutely does.
And I want to thank Maria for just making me pause and think a little bit about what I was saying and the way that I was saying it. Yeah, I really want to make that. I want to underline that point that sex work is just another form of work. And I think what I think more clearly is that any form of work is problematic, including working in a university. Actually, if it is the only choice available to one for surviving, you know, luckily we're not in that position, but many trans people are. So I think I want to emphasize that, and I think that didn't come out all that clearly. So there we go.
Yeah. And I really loved your point, Sam, about, you know, the way that culture and religion and, I mean, that's what we're dealing with at the moment in some research we're doing here around conversion practices, you know, in terms of, well, our faith says this and our God, and this constant need to deconstruct those privileged positions or the powerful positions, the powerful voices, the gatekeepers who present a particular version of their faith or a particular version of their culture. And one of the things that we're doing at AGMC, especially around LGBTIQ plus Muslims, and shout out to Aizia Zaharin, who invited me to write with her on transgender and Islam. And in the International Journal of Transgender Health, I'm so excited for Aizia to do this. I think one of the things we go back to is, okay, what was there in those cultures, in those faiths, pre-colonization, pre-Christianization, or, you know, Islamic Wahhabism, for example. So again, that deconstructing of what Sam, you know, pointed out, like what's going on in faiths, what's going on in cultures, what are those statements that they say are definitive and absolute, but how do we actually interrogate, unpack, as you said, Maddie, is really important.
We might move to the next question, but that was a very good discussion and I really appreciate both of your contributions. This flows quite nicely onto the next question. Much of your work deals with the telling and retelling of stories of people who are often denied the ability to speak for themselves. And as you said, you both consider yourselves allies and you are using your platforms of visibility and rights to, you know, get visibility and rights for those who don't have it. How do you as researchers manage narrating case studies without reaffirming, you know, an us and them divide, and I get to speak and you don't, or I get to speak about you and you don't get to speak about yourself?
So in asking that question, you're talking about a divide, an alleged divide, between researchers and research?
Oh, not necessarily. More about between people who have rights and people who don't, I suppose, if that makes sense. That can be about researchers, but I'm also thinking about public commentators or the media commenting on how people who are denied voices get to represent themselves. Does that make sense?
Sort of.
Okay.
For me, and I know it does with you, Sam, in transgender health, and for me, these are questions that sit and should be sitting on my shoulders all the time. These are the questions that should be guiding and framing what I do. And so I rely on the concepts of allyship, and I rely on decolonial research practice. Eileen Morton Robinson's Linda Tuhi Weiss-Smith's work all the time. And that for me is about collaboration, not appropriation. It's about constantly finding ways to support and provide spaces for lived experience, for voices to come through, and then knowing when to step back and get out of the way and leave communities too when it's safe, et cetera, to do so. Decolonial practices, I just working to the in places such as the people I work with in research own their material. They can use their material in any way they want. I do refuse to be part of any research team or any research work that does not have those very strong constructs of allyship and decolonial practice. And I learnt that very strongly from working with Indigenous communities, and I think it should be applied everywhere. It does mean there's another great theory that came out of the States called queer coyote researchers from people on that border of Mexico and the colonizer and the colonized, etc. research, and that means that it all that we also then take the risks that we understand. We make a commitment, and the commitment is called compromiso, and the commitment is to work for and work with. And just because a research project ends, it doesn't mean that we suddenly disappear. Thanks very much for your so-called data. Off I go. And you'll never hear from me again. So this constant relationality, this constant communication, collaboration, and this constant awareness that, I mean, I'm 60 now, so I'm on my way out. What legacy do I leave? How do I support and encourage younger academics, especially younger academics who might be first in family, which is another term that our universities have come up with, hey Sam, but also, you know, younger people who are coming through from marginalized perspectives who can write about themselves. And it also means being open to criticism. I mean, I cringe when I look at some of my earlier work, and I invite academics to critique it, feedback it, and extend it. So all those practices, I think, are very important. The last thing I would say, and Sam, please come in and, you know, critique and, like, I was asked by the Equinox Gender Centre here in Melbourne to undertake an evaluation of the gender centre, and here I am, a cisgendered heterosexual woman, doing this work, and it was these issues were very strongly coming to the fore in how I do the research, who I did the research with, the voices that needed to come through, that needed to be foregrounded. And it was an absolute honour to be invited on and find points of connection, but also honour the points of difference and honour lived experience in the writing up of this. So I had certain skills as an evaluator, as a researcher, as an academic, rah, rah, rah. But for me, ultimately, in anything I do, it's about what does the community require? What will the community I make of this, and how does the community own it? And dare I say, it's put me into a bit of trouble with university politics.
Thanks, Maria. Sam, what do you think?
Well, I don't think so much of my work involves case studies, but I think, you know, the question that you're asking is one that could be asked of all research. And the simple answer is to work with trans people as partners. Now that can mean a lot of different things. But if I can just digress, just talk for 3 minutes maybe about a recent research project in four countries: Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, and Malaysia, and that we did a couple of years ago, and we're still reporting it. We did a job audit in which we sent applications for jobs that had actually been advertised in those four countries. We had initially constructed CVs that we could be absolutely confident were equivalently attractive in the job market in each of the job sectors in each of the countries that we were researching in, and we did that by applying for jobs and looking at responses. And once we were sure that we had pairs of CVs that were equivalently attractive, we added some information to one of them to indicate that the applicant was trans. And then we just carried on applying for jobs that had been advertised, and we just counted the callbacks. And that was research that we did in partnership with Asia Pacific Transgender Network, the regional trans organization, trans-led organization. We got a little bit of funding from UNDP. No, through UNDP, we got some funding from a private donor. We liaised with local trans organisations in each of the four countries, and well, most of our research assistants were trans themselves, and so in the formulation of the research, in the design of the research, the prosecution of the research, in the reporting of the results, we were working with the trans community as partners, and I think that's really, really very important.
Sam, that just does my heart such joy. It's just the kind of research that I just wish was across the board, you know, that what you've described there is the model that I think we need to make sure is there, because sometimes in our corporatized managerialist universities, you know, it is something that we have to insist on, and it's just wonderful to hear.
I think there is a problem now, more than there was 20 years ago when I started working in this field, in some... what I want to say is that there is an increasing antagonism, I think, in some quarters between researchers and the trans community. This is not a worldwide phenomenon, but there are sectors, I think, within both communities in some places in the world that do cause me some concern. I do see increasingly that cisgender people, cisgender researchers are seen as in a hostile way. And now sometimes that hostility is justified. Sometimes it's not, and it's very generalized. I could go on for 40 minutes on this, but if I can just give you one example. Increasingly in the social media, cisgender people are referred to as the cis, which is a reference to Star Wars, the Sith. Now, as I recall, the Sith were the antithesis of the Jedi. Am I right?
Yes, you are.
Right. So, sorry, I don't want to put too much of a spotlight on.
Interesting. I haven't even known that.
I don't want to put too much of a. I don't want to make too much of a thing. Blow something up, which is really just a clever pun, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's. I think it's symptomatic of something that I think the community and cis researchers are going to have to deal with. They're really going to have to deal with it, because I think that I honestly think that both communities, the research community and the trans community, the researchers and the cis researchers at least, and the researched, will stand to lose if the allyship that does exist is not built upon but is undermined. And I see some dangerous trends towards an increased undermining of the allyship, that relationship that has begun to get us somewhere.
No, that's a very good response, Sam. Thanks for that. I think that's really important to consider the ways in which allyship is useful and also developing and faces those responses. Okay, so
Matt, I was going to say, Sam, that is so important, and it is a bit of a heads up, because I guess I have seen it. I don't see it, thankfully, so far, but I'm sure I'll be caught up to it if I ever, overstep by my communities. But it is something to be aware of. Again, it's that what you said, Maddie, about identities, and where identities can be enveloping and supportive, but sometimes if we allow, the labelling can also be divisive, and it's more in terms of action and what we do rather than the labels that we have, researched, et cetera. And what about those of us who are both the researched and the researchers, For example, every time I read anything about migration, it's like, oh, yeah, I'm there as the researched and the researcher. So I think they're very important points that you make, Sam, and we've got to be aware that we don't undo the amount of work that's been done so far and the amount of work that needs to be done if we're constantly worrying about who does what and why. I think it's about how we all collaborate and be very clear about power structures.
Thanks, Maria. That's great. And it leads very nicely into the next question. Michel Foucault, who is, for readers who aren't familiar, he was a famous postmodern, well, would he call himself a postmodernist? Probably not. But he was a famous philosopher, and he once wrote, "Visibility is a trap." I wonder to what extent is the project of inclusion in health also one of surveillance, and how might that relate to your work?
Well, shall I go first?
Yes, please.
And this time I'll try not to ramble on quite so much.
I'm enjoying the conversation.
I would return to that point that the critical problem for trans people has been of invisibility up to now, and that to some extent that's still a problem. I am aware that, I mean, I think this goes to the issue of gatekeeping, because in those parts of the world where there is healthcare to access, gender affirming healthcare that one can access, so often the criticism has been one that the professionals act as gatekeepers. And that gatekeeping is in some sense institutionalized by things like the WPATH standards of care, which is currently being revised. There is this tension, I think, between wanting access to healthcare and having to submit oneself to the sort of I think many trans people find demeaning gatekeeping assessment processes that go on, and there's an increasing move towards an informed consent model, which, as the name suggests, is far more focused on simply ensuring that the person understands what they're doing and then makes a decision.
Yep, that's great, Sam. Maria, what do you think?
I guess for me there's just different forms of surveillance. Some I welcome, some I, like Sam, I really, part of my work as an advocate, activist and academic is to, I guess in a way, derail that surveillance or critique it. I welcome surveillance from research participants. Like Sam says, I welcome surveillance from the communities I work for. So like with the Indigenous, the Mobs and Wogs project, my steering committee is made up of many Indigenous leaders, elders, who, you know, I want them to scrutinise what I do, how I do it. And it's the same with any work I've done for AGMC, is to have a group of people who will oversee and who can say to me, no, you've just missed that bit, or you didn't understand that about my life. Or there's a whole policy out there that you know you need to be made aware of, and we'd love you to go and challenge the policy, not constantly consider us. But, you know, those sorts of things. The surveillance I do worry about, and as an academic, is sometimes the debilitating grant processes, the ways that some people from marginal communities are not able to produce a grant application or a submission for funding, or have more control over funding because they have to construct their applications. They're under surveillance in the very way they go about constructing an application or managing their funding, being monitored, and those sorts of things can be very... And unfortunately, I've been subjected to that, where my allegiance was to a minority community who had managed to get a little bit of money, and that money was for that small minority, mostly minoritized community, and to have to come under the surveillance, and not an ethical surveillance, which we all need in terms of finances, but a surveillance of you know, a university or a system or particular people in power there who want to own the research, own the money. That kind of surveillance, I think we working in these institutions need to speak up and be able to critique.
So last week, I read that it was the 3-year anniversary of the same-sex marriage postal survey result. In this time, have you studied or found data or heard accounts indicating a lasting traumatic or otherwise negative response in mental health or physical health or any other kind of health for queer people? How do you think other recent events, such as the Religious Freedoms Act, Mark Latham's crusade against safe schools, how have these events compounded this trauma, if there is such a trauma?
Depends on the communities I've been working with. So, for example, the marriage equality, let's just start with that one, where for many of our multicultural, multi-faith communities, it did compound harm, mental health concerns. Sometimes it opened wounds that families had kind of, you know, agreed to disagree on or not discuss. It had picked at the scar tissue of issues around homo, bi, trans, you know, queer phobia. In other ways, though, with multicultural, multi-faith LGBTIQ communities, we found that those faiths or those cultures that, you know, see family as children and constructing a family and having children to take care of you in your old age, some of those tropes, I guess, that for some people incredibly valuable, marriage equality actually led to connection and cohesion, sometimes in funny ways where you had grandparents going, oh, you can get married now, so, you know, find a great same-sex partner and go and get married, have your kids. But that raises the other issue of mental health, because in some of our communities, especially bisexual, polyamorous, consensually non-monogamous communities, trans communities, gender diverse communities, it actually created harm because it was this heterosimulationist narrative of what it means now to be a good gay person. And that was, okay, you can get married now. So suddenly it became more about adhering to certain norms of marriage, monogamy, mortgage, the triple M's, rather than let's queer up relationships, let's queerify the ways people live, the ways that we all can share the raising of children without having to be biological parents. So I've seen both of those, and the ongoing onslaughts with the religious freedom, inverted commas, bill and the safe school stuff is constantly moving on the borders of those two, where people are constantly having more conversations in their homes and in their communities. But there is still a sense that some communities and some ways of being queer are being missed out, are again now being under surveillance. They're being legitimated or illegitimated, sometimes within their own LGBTIQA+ communities. And that's been very difficult, working for the poly communities, working for bisexual communities, trans communities, working for culturally diverse communities. Lots of different ways of doing this. I think I've made a mess of that answer, but Sam, help me out.
I think, first thing, there is a bit of research to show just the extent to which that debate around the postal survey, running up to the postal survey, did actually contribute to add to psychological distress for LGBTI+. People. I know that there was a study in the Australian Journal of Psychology last year by Saan Ecker and others that convincingly, I think, demonstrated that. And one can only imagine that debates around safe schools and so on and so forth have the same sort of effect, although I'm not aware of any study that's been done. There may be one out there, I just haven't done the due diligence yet. I would refer to that research by Ecker and others. I think on one level, the impact of the equal marriage legislation on trans people was very beneficial because it meant that various states and territories had to go back and look at their legal gender recognition legislation to take out clauses which require trans people to get divorced, married trans people to get divorced before they change their birth certificate as a prerequisite for changing their birth certificate. So that offered a window of opportunity to look more broadly in some states and territories at what sorts of reforms, legal reforms, needed to be done. So in Tasmania, for example, you have some of the most progressive legislation in the world now, and it pretty much started with the equal marriage legislation passing 3 years ago, I think. I think I may be simplifying there, but I think that's a fair simplified summary. But I do want to say this, that I think that perhaps the people who have suffered most in the last 3 years, and it's linked to the equal marriage legislation, is trans people. I think what's happened is this, that there are various conservative forces across Australia who had been so very energized against equal marriage, lost that battle, and have now turned their attention very energetically, very passionately, very systematically at trans people, their rights, and their health, access to healthcare, particularly perhaps trans youth. And so trans people, I think, in Australia are really going through they're really going through quite a difficult time. Right now, you have conservative organisations like CAUSE in Victoria. You have the ACL, the Australian Christian Lobby. You have academics like John Whitehall, at the University of Sydney. You have people like Mark Latham. You have newspapers like The Australian and journalists like Bernard Lane. You have a really unholy alliance. And let's not forget women's...
Binary Australia. Binary Australia is another one.
Thank you. And I was thinking of Women Speak Tasmania. And you have a fairly unholy alliance of Christian conservatives, medical conservatives, a vanishingly small number of them. You have conservative politicians whose motives who knows what their motives are in any one particular case. And you have feminists, some feminists at least, who are now engaged, I think, in a really, I call it an unholy alliance against trans people and their rights, including rights to healthcare, and that's really something that reflects what's happened elsewhere in the world. You can really see that the same thing happened in the United States. Of course, there are so many things happening in the United States. Trump being one of them. He came to. He actually took over in early 2017, of course. When was the Obergefell marriage equality thing? It was around about that time. So there are lots of things happening at the same time, but no doubt about it, trans people in the United States are under fire right now. In the United Kingdom, 16 years ago in 2004, the United Kingdom passed legal gender recognition legislation that at its time was really probably the most progressive in the world, with a minimum of hullabaloo. 16 years later, the world has moved on. The 2004 Gender Recognition Act is not as progressive as it once was. And the attempt to bring the United Kingdom up to date, up to speed with with much of the rest of the world, is stymied by a massive campaign undermining the legislative initiative. I think that campaign against trans people's rights, and that's there are campaigns against healthcare too for trans youth in the United Kingdom. It's just gender recognition is just one of the things that has been a casualty of this cultural battle. I think that battle has been all the more intense after equal marriage legislation passed in the United Kingdom. Same thing happening. All of the energy, all of the focus passes towards and is directed towards trans people.
Thanks, Sam. Mm. Yeah, that's really unfortunate and kind of goes back to a little bit of what I was saying in my previous question about visibility being a trap. The more something is raised into a public conversation, as Maria said, it can create change, it can create conversations, but it does also leave room for vulnerability, unfortunately. So I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you both so much for joining me and for your considerate responses. I think one of the main things that I've drawn from both of your responses today has been the importance of understanding research about queer and trans people as dynamic, as nuanced, as something that you need to consult or collaborate with your, you know, research subjects, and this I guess tension between visibility and safety as well. There's lots of things to think about. Thank you so much to both of you again for joining me, and thanks to everyone listening. I look forward to the next one. Until then, this has been In Queer Minds. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Sam.
Bye. Thank you, Maria.